On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for January 10th, 2018, the Infinity War edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C. John Dickerson of CBS This Morning is back after a brief hiatus elsewhere. Hi, John Dickerson. Where are you? You're in New York.
Hi, I'm in New York City. I'm in the CBS radio offices.
Oh, you said that with a good, sonorous CBS radio kind of voice. And Emily, the Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, is in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
On this week's show, the government shutdown, week 47. How long will it continue? Is there anything that could break the stalemate that we have on the government shutdown and the wall? Then the latest developments in the Mueller investigation, what do they portend for the overall investigation? Is there now evidence of collusion? Plus, why is everybody, including us, so obsessed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? We will talk about her and the interest in her and then her ideas, which are really fascinating. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And before we get any further, got an exciting announcement. John and Emily, you didn't even know this was coming. We have a live show coming up here in Washington, D.C., my hometown, at the Lincoln Theater on Wednesday, March 27th. Wednesday, March 27th. And this is not just a regular show, because we're going to have a special Emily Bazelon book show. Emily's new book, Charged.
Yes.
Charged, the new movement to transform American prosecution and end mass incarceration, which is great. I know. I've read it. It's going to be available for attendees 2 weeks before the release date. Emily's going to do a book signing afterwards. You can go and hang out with Emily after the show. So go to slate.com/live for information and tickets. We will do a regular GabFest, but we will also talk, of course, about Emily's fantastic book and the policy issues that it raises. And is there a book? Can people get a book with their ticket, Emily? I don't even know.
Yes, people can get a book with their ticket, even though the book will not be on sale for everyone else until April 9th.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa. Mind blown.
And I am hoping that our GabFest friends are going to help me feel happy about this book launch, which is otherwise terrifying event. Books are so hard, guys. So if
God, they really are. Yeah, and you're freaking me out with the whole book launch thing.
No,
because
come on out. Come on out. Support Emily.
Wednesday, March 27th, in DC. It would be so nice and affirming. But John, why is that terrifying for you? You're at a nice beginning-ish stage of your own book.
I don't know. I just flash forward to the. I don't know.
Yes,
I don't know.
It's true. One can drum up anxiety from beginning to end.
Yes, exactly. It's just this huge floating ball of anxiety from which you cannot untether yourself.
You're sending the wrong message. Emily, it's going to be amazing. Emily's book
is amazing. No, it's going to be great for her. She's passed the post.
Slate.com/live. Get tickets for Wednesday, March 27th.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. It's going to be great.
The government shutdown will shortly be the longest in history, and it is a national embarrassment. The president's much ballyhooed speech on Tuesday night turned into a big pile of not very much, which is fortunate for Democrats because their response was quite feeble, in my opinion. The administration is attempting to show there's a national emergency on the border. In fact, as we tape, the president seems to have gone to the border to hype this idea that there's a national emergency. There is, however, no evidence of that. There's not a rise in crossings, not a rise in detention of terrorist suspects or of people on watch lists. The numbers of people who are crossing and potentially a threat to national security are mind-bogglingly small, and the administration still is deceptive about that. So yet the president persists with his insistence on getting wall funding in the budget, and compromise seems distant. The House, the democratically controlled House, is starting to pass funding bills for individual departments, but Senate Republicans do not seem yet prepared to act and also pass those bills, or at least even vote on those bills. So there's got to be some kind of break in this. The president may invoke emergency powers and say he's going to use funding that's intended for the Department of Defense to build the wall, a move that I think many people, including, I'm sure, our own Emily Bazelon, think is illegal. Senate Republicans may break with him and vote on bills that he doesn't want to sign. The president may find some other way to declare victory. Yesterday, on Wednesday, he stormed out of a meeting with Democrats when Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, said she would not fund the wall under any circumstances. So, John, what might break the stalemate?
Well, I don't know. But let me just go back to your original riff, because I think there's so many things to be focused on here. But first of all, let's go back to the founding of the country. One of the biggest things the founders worried about was that a president would declare a fake emergency for the purposes of seizing more power for the office than they were granted. So we're basically at starting point of one of the fundamental fears of the use of the presidency. Secondly, you quite rightly pointed out that the evidence marshaled to make the case that this is an emergency was thin or non-existent or completely untrue. And that obviously, what was striking is the president, who has broken so many norms of the office, and not just broken them, but gone exactly in the opposite direction, and also considered those norms to be just kind of fake and phony, then was trying to rely on one of the strongest symbols of the presidency, of the old presidency, the kind that existed before the president, which was an Oval Office address. But this is, like taking some herb that you would use in cooking and, throwing it on the floor for 2 years and then suddenly hoping that the herb will season the dish that you're making. It's not effective.
I've done that. I've tried that.
And finally, I would say that we should remember that the argument the president is saying is that this is an emergency. Not that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, but that there is something acute and immediate that is happening. And secondly, not just that it is acute and immediate, but that it requires the kind of emergency that the emergency measures that are already being taken. And what are those emergency measures that are being taken? Well, they're not actually to build a wall or address the actual underlying problem. The emergency measures are the ones that are happening by neglect, which is to say people are not getting paychecks or they're about to not get paychecks. And it's disrupting the lives of the 800,000 or so federal workers. So the emergency measures are already being taken. They're just causing emergencies for people unrelated to the underlying case. And that's what's so out of whack here.
Well, also, John, just to jump on that a little bit more, to say there's an emergency at the border and we have to grapple with it, and then the solution is a years-long project, incredibly slow, tedious project to build a barrier, which does not – that is not addressing an emergency. Addressing some long-term need, potentially.
David Frum put it this way. He said it's like if your house is on fire and somebody rushing in to say, okay, now let's build a new fire station, right? So it's not – there are emergencies. Heroin is coming. It's just not coming over the southern border in the way the president suggests. So there are things that are happening on the immigration front that are acute, and there are people overwhelming the system, and money could be applied towards making the system better. But that's not money that goes into a wall.
Well, in light of all of that, because I think that is an excellent unpacking of the reality of where we are, why are Republican senators and most Republicans in the House sticking so closely to Trump? There is something that feels faith-based to me about their response. Because the wall is super popular with Trump supporters. I understand that's the core base of the Republican Party, but it is not popular with independents and other perhaps gettable voters. And when you pair it with shutting down the government, it is really not popular. So I just don't – I get the idea that they're all scared that if they come forward one by one, Trump will pick them off and they will lose their elections plus be humiliated. But if they banded together, which is what you have to do to stop a bully, it just seems to me like they could expose – a lie here. And I guess the answer to my own question is that would be detrimental to their own party. But I really wonder about the politics for them.
I mean, he's a bully in their gang, though. Like, that's the problem. He's not a bully who's bullying them. He's a bully. They're part of the gang of bullies. And so they recognize that he's a bully. And actually, it's no fun to be part of this gang. But they don't have a they're not victims in the way the rest of us are victims.
Yeah, but the gang, being part of the gang, could prove in the end to be their undoing, no? Like, the leader of the gang is leading them in a very unpopular
right,
direction.
Right, but this is like asking a mob. This is like, why don't mobsters turn on their mob bosses when they, even though they know it's probably going to end badly on for them? Because it's they're tied in. They've made their bed. They've gotten. I mean, to mix like 100 metaphors, they've gotten in bed with this person, and so it's much harder to get out of that bed than it is if you've never gotten in bed with them to begin with.
I think that's all true. But I think also based on the response and some of what I've heard from the president's supporters is he has in the party, you know, let's call it base plus, and I don't know what the plus is.
There is no plus. Some number.
Well, there, you know, there
on this
no.
issue.
Anyway, so there's the base who will basically believe whatever the president tells them, and then there is some group beyond that. And what happens is people say, but there is a problem at the border. And so that's what Republicans are having lawmakers. And there are five in the Senate, by the way, who said they would reopen the government, which if you take those five plus the Democrats, you have a majority. It's just that Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, who is completely absent from this debate, which just, by the way, we should stop there and think that the Article I branch in the Senate is waiting for the president to decide what to do, which, again, going back to the way this whole government thing was supposed to work, is an extraordinary perversion of the way the co-equal branches are supposed to work. But anyway, the five have broken, and the calculation for the other is, it seems to me, is the group of people who think that if they side with the Democrats, which is what this would look like, they're handing a defeat to their president. And they, in their thinking, they say, but there is a problem at the border. So they conflate emergency with merely a problem that needs to be addressed.
So, Emily, here's something I just don't understand also, another thing I don't understand. If this is such a big deal for people, if the immigration crisis is such a big deal for the president. Now, I understand the president is a rhetorician who doesn't actually care about policy and doesn't really want to get anything done. But let's pretend that he does. It's weird that there's such a great chance for a negotiation here. People seem to feel the stakes are quite high. So I don't see why Democrats aren't saying, OK, you can have your wall. The price of the wall is DACA, reform of, H-1B program. It's all these other aspects of immigration reform that Democrats are keen on and saying, yes, let's work to secure the southern border. And you have an idea of how to do it and your wall, whatever. We'll give you some funding for that. But here are the pieces that we would like in exchange. And it's so odd to me that there isn't an attempt at legislative compromise. That's what legislation is for. That is the whole point of these massive bills, is to swap things and people give up stuff and gain stuff. Why isn't that on the table in a reasonable way?
Yeah, they had tried.
I know why.
Failed, but
right.
They tried it before. I don't know why it's not a part. I mean, Lamar Alexander and others tried to do one of the ways you try and solve these problems is make them bigger, or not make the problem bigger, but make the solution bigger. And Lamar Alexander suggested a version of what you're talking about, which is use this crisis moment to go for broke on a comprehensive immigration reform. The problem is that it doesn't seem like the president has any appetite to do what some people thought 2.5 years ago he had unique opportunity to do, which is a president who calls himself a deal maker and who has no allegiance really to his party, either financially or ideologically, could come in and say, I'll take some of you from the Democratic side and some of you from the Republican side. And now we've just solved an immigration issue that's, bedeviled the parties for a long time. But that isn't happening. He doesn't seem to be inclined to do that.
Right. I mean, I think that it wouldn't work, that Trump wouldn't go for comprehensive immigration reform. And when Pelosi and Schumer thought they had a DACA deal with him, he then backed out, leaving them like holding the bag. So I think that's part of the reason. But you're right, David, that they could still call his bluff. And I think part of the answer is the way in which Trump has polarized the debate, so that you have this moment where Pelosi is calling the wall immoral, in addition to expensive and a waste of money and impractical, actually immoral. And I think that the Democratic base is demanding that of her, and that there would be this sense of, total betrayal if the Democrats were to sign on to a wall. And so that's how you have these such polarized stances here, right? Which so seem – I mean, I suppose that instead of attributing this to Trump, you could also say that it's the Democrats being just as recalcitrant. But I don't think that's right. I think this insistence on the wall, which was this, like, campaign device that it's clear the Republican Party doesn't really care about. It's not a priority for most of the Republican lawmakers. It's kind of forced Democrats into drawing this particular line in the sand, and then you can't have the usual kind of wheeling and dealing or even the pretense of it. But I think in the end, it's because Trump just wouldn't do this. Like, we have no evidence that he would be the kind of statesman deal maker that, you know, we just outlined.
As a someone who generally sympathizes with the Democrats, I feel like chaining themselves to the position that this is immoral doesn't do that much good. I mean, there are a lot of immoral things that are happening. I think the way we've separated families is immoral. The way our asylum policies are fundamentally immoral. The wall intrinsically does not seem immoral in the same way that other policies the Trump administration is pursuing are immoral. And I want to return to a point that David Leonhardt made last time, which is that this set of issues, generally border security, immigration issues, is not the territory the Democrats want to be spending the next 2 years fighting over. It's a bad territory. And what has happened? So where are we? January 10th? 11th? Yeah. So this is the first week of this new Democratic majority in the House. And do we hear anything about anything except the border and immigration and the shutdown? No. I mean, there's nothing about the positive Democratic agenda that is breaking through. There is.
Yeah, but the shutdown. They've lost the terms of the debate. The Democrats think the shutdown is good for them.
Well, the shutdown is bad for everybody. The shutdown is. Right. It's true. Relatively, it is better for Democrats politically, maybe, than it is for Republicans, but it's bad for the country.
Yes,
and
true.
But when things are bad for the country, Democrats shouldn't want them.
And David, and people should focus on your word intrinsically about the wall, because as Emily just pointed out, it has become, you know, it'd be interesting to maybe put a percentage on how much of the wall debate is actually about this literally physical barrier of the wall, and how much more of it is about all of the symbol around it and using the idea of a fence that keeps bad people out as a way to characterize a group of the population. And how, I mean, how it's gotten so much more of a symbol for both sides, obviously in different ways, than the intrinsic question of where to have a barrier, why to have a barrier. We should also throw in one other thing. Using eminent domain to take people's property, right, to put up a wall is
big
actually
deal.
Something a lot of conservatives, I mean, it's a big deal in its own terms, but B, a lot of conservatives used to be very much against.
Can I change our subject slightly, which is that I think we're losing sight of actually what Emily pointed out in the beginning is the national emergency, which is there's a government shutdown and we are on the verge of starting to have breakage in a way that is going to be truly damaging for the country. I think if I had a prediction about what is going to end the shutdown, it is the news yesterday that the FDA is not conducting routine food inspections. And so if we have one foodborne illness outbreak that happens in the next few weeks. If we go another month, we won't be able to pay out food stamps. They did some chicanery to pay food stamps this month. But
right.
If it goes another month, they won't be able to pay food stamps. They cannot. That is not possible. They cannot continue not paying food stamps. Food stamps have to go out or you're going to have mass crisis in this country. It clearly can't go more than a month without there being something hugely shaking. And it's very likely can't go much more than what it's going, because either airport travel becomes intolerable and Congress people will not bear that, because that's their rich, powerful constituents will not like that. Or there's something in the public health or in the environment where the government can't respond in the way it needs to respond, and the public rises up against that. So that to me is the thing we should be focusing on, is the damage being done to federal workers, the morale hit to the government, the destruction of the government's capacity to do good, and then the potential for an actual immediate emergency.
Can we just also add into this the, like, deep, deep injustice of forcing all these federal workers to work without pay? It just makes me so mad on their behalf. If I had to do that, if I was one of those TSA workers, you know, yes, in the end, probably they'll get their back pay. But in the meantime, people have bills. People have expenses. It's just infuriating.
This highlights the fact that 80% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck,
yes,
and a lot of the 800,000 here are in those positions. And it's probably worth mentioning again that or mentioning maybe for the first time, that the one of the things that, I mean, this is in fulfillment of a promise the president made in his campaign that would be paid for by Mexico. So in addition to the many other things going on here, this is a funding fight about something the president was extremely and repeatedly specific about well into his presidency. And just in terms of giving a sense of how the way we look at the presidency has shifted, when Barack Obama got into shutdown issues, there were a variety of pieces written and questions asked, and various people came forward and says, you know, why doesn't he reach out to Republicans more? Why doesn't he schmooze with them more? Why doesn't he have them over and break bread? And then people would haul out the old LBJ. And then if they were really on their soapbox, they'd talk about Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Those conversations aren't even, as far as I've seen, aren't even happening. In other words, everybody has already kind of baked in the cake the idea that President Trump has never really reached out to Democrats in any meaningful way, and don't even expect it. I mean, don't even call on him to do it. But that in lots and lots of previous presidencies, it would have been everybody would have been saying, why isn't this happening? Why isn't the president, who is the leader in a system where we overemphasize the powers of the presidency, why isn't he doing more to reach out? And that's not even really part of the conversation, no. Which gives you another sense of how things have shifted.
So, Emily, before we leave this topic, one of the possible outcomes, in fact, I think maybe the most likely outcome, is the president is going to weasel out of it by declaring a national emergency, stating he has now the right to spend money to start building the wall, and it'll get tied up in the courts, and then the appropriations bills can pass sort of on a separate channel. Everyone will forget about the shutdown piece of it. Is it legal for the president to declare a national emergency in this circumstance, and what would it theoretically entitle him to do?
I mean, I think it is deeply unconstitutional. That said, there is a plausible legal argument, but really that should not sit with us. For the reasons John started out with, this is not what the framers intended when they were trying to protect us from presidents usurping power. So we have this 1976 law called the National Emergencies Act, and it actually was passed to try to manage and contain the ways in which presidents had been allowed to declare emergencies and then spend money. But it was passed at a time when Congress thought that it had more veto power than the Supreme Court later decided that it actually had. And so what we have is this like very ineffective legal patchwork where we have these two laws, and you referred to them earlier, David, that seem to give the president some leeway, if he declares a national emergency, to take money that's been appropriated by Congress for some military for some military spending, and then use it for a different kind of military spending. So you have those laws, and then the argument the Trump administration would make is like, we're reappropriating funds that Congress already gave the Defense Department for this other purpose, which the president declares is necessary because of this national emergency. Then the problem is that any president can make anything into a national emergency. There is just no limit on what that means. And so then you would be asking the courts to step in and say, hey, wait a second. There is no emergency here. We can't accept this completely pretextual bullshit explanation for why there is an emergency. And yet then you return to this like statutory hole we have. Well, but if the National Emergencies Act says that an emergency is whatever the president says it is, then like who can stop Trump from making this declaration, even if it has zero evidence behind it? That just cannot be the right answer, right? Like it, constitutionally speaking, allows the president so much leeway to defy the will of Congress that it just seems like a violation of the separation of powers. It particularly seems wrong constitutionally because of the famous steel seizure cases. This is, Truman famously during the Korean War tried to make steel mills continue to produce. He said that there was an emergency because of the Korean War. And the Supreme Court said, no, wait a second. If Congress, there are various like levels of presidential power. But if Congress decides not to allow the president to, not to authorize certain presidential conduct, then the president is at the nadir of his power and he really can't just like go ahead and do this anyway. And in this situation, that's what we've got, right? We've got Congress refusing to appropriate the money for the wall. And so the notion that Trump can get around that by declaring a bogus national emergency when there is none, like that just cannot be the right answer. And I feel like because this could be the way out of the shutdown impasse, people are being kind of blasé about what this will mean for rule of law and presidential power if we just like allow this to happen and then it turns into this court fight, which, you know, like I said, there's sort of this plausible statutory argument. And so we'll all march along taking that seriously. But really, this is like really bad stuff.
Do you think it gets to the Supreme Court? And if it got to the Supreme Court, do you have any sense of how it would be handicapped?
Yeah, it absolutely gets to the Supreme Court. I mean, I think the big question is whether a district court issues a stay and doesn't allow the wall building to go forward. And so we have a kind of, you know, in the meantime, a halt on the wall while it all gets litigated. Yes, well, it will go to the Supreme Court. I mean, when you look at the travel ban case, it doesn't look very good for the challengers of Trump's actions because the Supreme Court was willing to accept a, you know, made up explanation in that case. Now, arguably, that was a whole different context because in the field of immigration, the president's power is at its zenith. He's just got a lot of power over our borders. And I know this is also a border issue, but because it's tied up in this question of Congress not appropriating funds for a particular means of addressing immigration, I think it should be different. But I mean, I don't especially want to bet on the Supreme Court. On the other hand, it just seems like it's so clearly the wrong answer under the Constitution. Right. You got to hope that they would come to that conclusion.
A lot of hands.
GAPFIS listeners are Googling nadir and zenith right now.
Yeah, which would be a good thing to name your two dogs. Emily, or David too, could the president do the emergency powers, go have the first court slap back or stay on the building of the wall, but basically say, okay, I'll sign whatever stopgap spending measure you and Congress need to do because the courts are going to validate me ultimately anyway. I mean, in other words, this
yes.
is a way to get out of this.
Yes, that's, so he, yeah, that's what he's, yeah.
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 Yeah, I'm sorry, did I miss that? That or but yeah. I was just going back to the funding of the government part, not the constitutional.
Yeah, but I think Emily's
part.
Point is that it creates a terrible precedent.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets us past this immediate road bump,
well,
but at the cost of like a serious.
Well, if he gets shot down, then it's not then the cost is not there. Then there's no cost.
Yes, if he got shut down by the courts in a clear and emphatic way, then that would be a good limitation. I just don't have complete faith that will happen or happen quickly. Right. And I worry about the alternative. Also, this is yet one more instance in which we discover that these hugely important foundations of the American system are based on norms, not law. And I guess we could thank Trump for exposing that, but only if we're going to fix them later. And what I worry about is that by pushing these boundaries, Trump is, as you were saying, David, earlier, just creating a terrible precedent, even if he doesn't get away with it.
Hey, Slate Plus members and non-Slate Plus members. Slate Plus members, you, of course, get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. And your bonus segment today, we're excited for it, although we're not quite sure what it's going to be, but it's going to be about favor mongering. We have the phrase. We just don't know the outlines, the contours of the discussion, but it will be amazing because those are always the best ones, are the ones where we know there's something we want to talk about, but we don't know why. So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today and get such vague topics as favor mongering and other things discussed by us in bonus segments and also great bonus segments on other Slate podcasts as well as other bonus content.
It would be a huge favor if you did that.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Okay, your weekly Mueller news diet. Paul Manafort accidentally reveals, or his lawyers accidentally reveal, that he passed polling data on to a Russian associate of his, Konstantin Kalimnik, who was then in turn going to pass it on to an oligarch, Oleg Deripaska. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name. No certainty about where that was ending up. That is private polling data. Who knows what it was going, where it was going, why it was going there, what Manafort was doing, passing it along. Also, the Russian lawyer in the Trump Tower meeting was indicted on charges totally separate from her involvement in the Trump Tower meeting. Also, Rod Rosenstein is leaving the Department of Justice as soon as Bill Barr is confirmed as Attorney General. Also, we learned that Bill Barr and Robert Mueller are good friends, for what that's worth. Anything else? Any other headlines that I missed? I feel like there's one other that I missed, but we won't. We'll leave it there.
I thought that was a good summary.
Emily, what is important about what was revealed in that Manafort filing? And were his lawyers just total morons for revealing, or are we just making too big a deal about the fact that they accidentally appear to have revealed some stuff?
I mean, I think it's a big deal that they messed up how to redact a document and left it searchable, even though they thought they had blacked out copy. That is not competent lawyering.
I definitely would have done that.
Totally. I definitely felt the same way. I was like, oh my God, I bet I have done that. Good thing I've never had to redact anything I've posted publicly. Anyway, why is this a big deal? Well, it's evidence of the Trump campaign giving campaign-related information to someone who was both involved in, you know, Ukrainian politics in a dicey way and also has ties to Russian intelligence, like seems to clearly be someone who is keeping Putin's regime informed. And it's all campaign related. Like, why was Manafort turning this data over? Why did Kalimnik want it? What did the Russians want with it? What were they doing with it? I mean, those are the unanswered questions. It could turn out that this was just Manafort coveting favor. He obviously was trying to get in. He was trying to settle his debts with Deripaska. And so maybe it was just simply about that, had nothing to do with Trump or the campaign. And yet one still wonders, like, what did the Russians want with this? What did Deripaska want? Could it be tied to the Russians interfering with the election, which we know happened subsequently? It's the first evidence of Trump campaign-related information passing through these suspicious channels.
And the question, so this was not just like Quinnipiac's latest poll. It was supposedly polling, private polling that was within the Trump campaign. So, you know, presumably the good stuff, right?
Yes.
The question is whether, or the question for me anyway, is whether this is Manafort, who's got bills to pay and is heavily indebted to the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, and that this was him trying to get right, essentially using his chairmanship and the promise of helping have inside skinny into the Trump campaign. And you could imagine the polling being used to say, no, he's a serious candidate. He might get elected. Don't follow all the actual public pundits and public polling that says Hillary Clinton's going to win. Here's the private polling that says he's going to win, and therefore you need a man on the inside. Therefore, you know, forgive me my debts. Was that Manafort trying to keep himself in ostrich skin coats and with fur collars, or was it part of collusion for the purposes of getting elected? And by the way, two things could have been going on at the same time.
Right.
Not either or.
That's very well put, John. There's the data. Marketing people were abuzz on Twitter because marketing people are obsessed with data and polling data, and that is the raw material. That is the material that all campaigns are built on, but all businesses are built on these days is data. So if it's in fact a rich data set, it does give a huge inside advantage to if the Russians are going to use that to actually target or to do something active with. So it could be not just proof of Trump's validity, but also, in fact, useful information that would allow the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg to commit acts of violence against American democracy as well. So as you say, it can be both of those things. There's nothing, Emily, in here that we've heard, however, that draws in the president. There's no implication that just because Manafort, who is clearly one of the worst people you will ever encounter if you're if you happen to be wandering around Washington, that Manafort is a bad actor. But there's not an implication that Manafort and the president are acting in concert together here, is there? That we know of?
No, not so far. I mean, I think there's nothing that rules that out, but there is no evidence in this particular revelation that that was going on. It just depends how this puzzle piece fits into the larger picture, right? I mean, we keep looking at each piece of the puzzle separately as it is revealed to us. And the real question is how Mueller's team is putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. And until we have the answer to that, it's just really hard to judge, or at least until we get another breadcrumb that shows a trail to Trump. You know, if you're imagining the Trump campaign wanting to help the Russians, then I think it gets harder to keep this away from Trump. But we just don't really know that yet. I will say, though, you know, in the sort of obsession with collusion, this is potentially evidence of information going back toward the Russians, right? Like, until now, it's been all about the Russians approaching the Trump campaign. This is like the Trump campaign or someone on the Trump campaign sending something back to the Russians. And, you know, since collusion isn't a crime in itself, it's this like shorthand we've been using. If you want to talk about conspiracy, which is a crime, like this would be good evidence for building a case of conspiracy.
Doesn't this also give us some insight into how much Mueller had, which more insight than we've already had, and we've had quite a lot about how much he really knows about stuff. I mean, in other words, now if this came from Gates, he's flipped Gates. So Gates is now working with the special counsel. So, you know, that seems, but it seems every time we learn a detail like this, we get further proof that that Mueller really has a very thorough understanding of what Manafort was doing. He keeps catching him lying. And if you extrapolate from that, it means there's lots more iceberg beneath the tip that we're seeing.
Emily, there was also the story this week that the president has staffed up on lawyers every I don't even know where they keep finding it, just as a reminder of how many lawyers there must be in Washington. But one of the things he's staffing up on lawyers to do is to try to prevent, sounds like, to try to prevent Mueller from sharing lots of his information with Congress, the public, mostly the public, I suppose, saying that it's covered by executive privilege and that these are conversations that the president was having with aides that shouldn't, that, you know, cannot be revealed publicly. What's your sense about how that's going to be resolved?
Well, this is the next frontier now the Democrats have taken over the House because they have subpoena power and they are going to ask for all kinds of information. And then the White House is going to refuse to turn a lot of it over and they're going to cite executive privilege and it's going to turn into a big prolonged legal battle, right? I mean, Congress can declare certain officials in contempt of Congress. You know, back in the day, a couple of times, I think, actually jailed people for contempt of Congress, but we haven't done that in a very long time. What is more standard is that you have a fight over the boundaries of congressional subpoena power versus executive privilege that gets tied up in the courts. I think the Trump administration will be like perfectly happy to have that fight. They'll have that fight over Trump's tax returns. They'll have that fight over a lot of information they don't want to turn over. And it's going to take a small army of lawyers to litigate it. But, you know, the notion that the Democrats are going to be able to like march in and all these mysteries are suddenly going to be revealed because all these documents are going to be instantly public, like that is not going to be the case.
The other news that I noted this week, Emily, was that Rod Rosenstein was going to be leaving once the new attorney general takes office, which kind of makes sense. Doesn't seem shocking. Rosenstein has been, I think people have seen him as the great shield and protector. People on the left have seen him as the shield and protector of the Mueller investigation. Do you think there should be grave concern about his departure? Do you think that's doesn't matter at this point, that Mueller clearly is going to be able to wrap up his investigation in the way he wants to?
I would really like to hear William Barr, when he has his confirmation hearings next week, swear under oath that he will not interfere with the Mueller investigation. You know, it is somewhat reassuring that Rosenstein has some faith in him. But, you know, Barr wrote that apoplectic, like, I mean, almost kind of bizarre memo criticizing the Mueller investigation. What Rosenstein has said about that is, well, he wrote that before he knew the facts, suggesting that once he knows the facts, he'll change his position. That seems perfectly plausible, and I don't see a real reason why Bill Barr would want to go down in history as the person who scotched the Mueller investigation. But he does have this deeply held belief in the unitary theory of the executive, which is basically that the president, you know, practically can't commit a crime. I'm exaggerating, but like barely. I mean, that so many things come under the authority of the president that if he wants to fire Jim Comey or, you know, pardon Flynn, he can do all these things. And so because Barr is so clearly on the record about that in a way that seems extreme, it seems vital for Congress to ask these questions and get assurances. Congress can't force Rosenstein to stay in his job. But I think the Justice Department has been surprisingly resilient in the face of these attacks and incursions on the rule of law, the, you know, Trump's like beating his chest and making the presidency more powerful than it should be. And anything that threatens that is something that we should be on the lookout for.
Well, the unitary theory of the executive, meaning the president, is the interpretation of the Constitution that says the president has total authority over the executive branch, which is why those firings would be okay. Whereas the Constitution is specific about the what circumscribes Congress, and so people who interpret it that way. But I don't see how that would mean he might be in a position to say, as you pointed out, anything the president did with respect to Flynn or Comey is fine, regardless of his motives. But if that contradicts what Mueller says, then that's a debate for the, you know, for Congress to have. Lindsey Graham has said the threshold question for Sessions' replacement is whether the new attorney general will allow this. He said this before Barr was in the mix, but will allow Mueller to finish his work unimpeded. And Graham has put those questions to Barr again in his tour around the Senate and said that Barr said he wasn't going to do anything to tell Mueller what to do or how to do it. But then the question is, how does he handle the whatever Mueller produces and does he help hide it? And I don't know how that would play out or how, because he will hand the report to Barr, right? And then Barr has to do whatever with it, whatever.
Yeah, presumably. And that's why we want Barr answering all these questions in front of the Senate publicly and under oath, right? So that we have
a better sense of.
Yeah. Unless, of course, all of this turns out to be moot because Pete Williams of NBC is reporting that Rosenstein has promised to stay after Barr is confirmed until Mueller submits his final report.
All right. Anything more on this topic before we go?
Well, one little thing we should mention, which is a mystery, which is that the Supreme Court decided not to step in a dispute between Mueller and some foreign-owned company that has been trying to resist his efforts to look into their activities. And the Supreme Court didn't side with the foreign-owned government, foreign-owned company. So we don't know what that's about. But it's caused a lot of skullduggery, and at one point they shut down the floor on which one of the intermediate legal proceedings was taking place, so nobody from the press could get on it, and it's all very secret.
Right, and the presiding judge has found that this company is in contempt of obeying a subpoena and has wanted to impose a fee of $50,000 a day until the company complied, and the Supreme Court refused to step in and save the company from paying that money. So presumably the clock is ticking, the money is flowing, and that should give the company a reason to comply with the subpoena.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
AOC, BFD, the obsession with the new member of Congress from Queens, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has reached extraordinary levels. The Democratic Socialist, the youngest woman ever elected to the House of Representatives, has appeared on 60 Minutes. She has become the number one target of conservatives furious about the move to the left of the Democrats in the House and the move to the left of Democrats generally. They are fixated on proving that Ocasio-Cortez is not authentic, that she doesn't come from a disadvantaged background. They are upset that her nickname was Sandy in high school. They say that she's shallow because she liked to dance while she was in college. They say that she's got crazy policy ideas, that she has no grasp of facts and lies like Trump. They have circulated fake nude photos of her, for goodness sake. At the same time, on the left, there's a huge excitement about what Ocasio-Cortez is bringing, a kind of brilliance in media that's quite remarkable. Her grasp and gift in media is extraordinary. She has successfully, I think, brought up policy proposals that have never been talked about in serious circles or haven't been talked about in serious circles on the left for decades, because she just brings a kind of vitality and credibility to them. I also learned that she won the second prize in the Intel Science Competition in high school. Did you guys know that? And there's, in fact, an asteroid named after her because she was second prize in the Intel Science Competition.
No way. That's so awesome. I love that.
Yeah. So why, Emily, is there such obsession with Ocasio-Cortez on left and right?
Well, she is the future, right? And so you either love it or you fear it. You're right. I think, what is this sort of brilliance in media and social media about? It's that she's fearless, or at least that's how she appears. So, like, this video of her dancing in college comes out. Conservatives put it out there supposedly to embarrass her. Lots of people love the exuberance and just like sheer fun of this video. And then she makes this other little snippet video of herself like dancing a tiny bit in her congressional office with this like great smile on her face. I mean, look, I'm totally charmed by her. But if you are someone who thinks like the left should have its articulate, smart, exciting champion, and that it's good to expand the window of the kind of policy proposals we talk about in terms of, you know, taxes and also the idea of this Green New Deal, then you welcome her presence. And then also the fact that she's this Latino woman from this incredibly diverse district is, like, exciting. If you're threatened by everything that represents, and, you know, you think the left is better off muzzled, then she's going to seem like an enormous threat. I think it's important to point out that these attacks on her authenticity have not seemed to have very much, or if any, factual basis to them whatsoever, right? So it just seems like the right keeps giving her a way to own them and dunk on them by attacking her for things that are just, like, ridiculous.
Part of what's happening, though, is people are, I mean, what does it mean for conservatives to have, like, been attacking her for that dancing video? There was also some clever, it wasn't exactly umbrage taking, but maybe it was, like, a lot of support, her supporters and people who like her and would like to use the idea of making fun of her for dancing as a way to paint the entire
right.
Yes.
You know, successfully use that. So, but, you know, that's whatever. That's politics. First of all, she's a giant slayer in that she is in Washington to begin with. And so that's what makes her interesting. And your point about the Overton window, which is to say the what is permissible to talk about now is really interesting in this sense to me, which is like the first place that's going to show up is in Democratic primaries. So normally what is in the marketplace of ideas in Democratic primaries is determined by what the candidates themselves talk about. And so, you know, if Herman Cain talks about his 999 plan, suddenly everybody's over talking about 999. But what if you have a person setting the terms of debate who is a social media star, who has this, who captures all of this attention, who's not even in the running? That, to me, if you're just interested in ideas bouncing around, and if you're interested in contests in which people have to do more than just kind of say the same old traditional things, then she's great for basically just throwing a cat amongst the pigeons.
And those two particular ideas that she's been most associated with, the Green New Deal and the high marginal tax rate to help fund it. So she's talked about a 70% marginal tax rate on incomes above $10 million a year, which right now that number is 37, 34, something much, much, much lower, are great ideas. They're great, exciting ideas. And on the marginal tax rate question, most Americans, when they understand what it is, are huge supporters of it. People who are making that much income, they should be taxed at a high level on that marginal income. That's one of the problems we've had is this enormous growth in wealth disparity because rich people, our tax system is progressive, but it's not progressive enough. And it really isn't that progressive when you start to talk about people who are earning huge amounts of money. Now, of course, there are reasons why a 70% marginal tax rate wouldn't necessarily address the wealth disparity. And there are lots of people who have lots of income that isn't earned income that would be taxed and blah, blah, blah. But it's a darn good opener as far as I'm concerned anyway.
If you're in favor of the idea of the battle of ideas, the reason it feels like it's a good opener is because it literally does open the window to a conversation about wealth disparity and income inequality and the roots of it. And as soon as you talk about 70%, you'll immediately get into a conversation about lobbyists and who has the power to influence the way that tax laws are written. Because you can be certain that if anybody were ever to actually get a 70% marginal tax rate through, you would have enough loopholes in tax legislation to allow the people who fund campaigns and who keep a lot of the people in power, they would certainly find a way to create the kind of loopholes that were in existence when marginal tax rates were at that level in previous periods in American history. So, but that's great to have debates and discussions about all of that from the sterile kinds of conversations we've had before. Right. So,
the Adam Serwer had an interesting column where he talked about the attacks on Ocasio-Cortez's authenticity and associates it with the attacks that were also made on Barack Obama's authenticity, the attempts to paint him as non-American. And Serwer makes an argument essentially that when minority politicians, minority powerful minority figures start to move into positions of power and expect to be treated and be given the respect and the authority that they have won, that there's often a white backlash against it. That the notion that these are people who are getting unearned benefits and they don't deserve it, and they are in fact stealing something from white people who aren't getting these special favors that these minority people are getting. Why do you think Ocasio-Cortez in particular has triggered that? Or has she? Maybe just people see it more visibly because she's been good at parrying it. And actually, there hasn't been that much. I don't know.
I think there is that because she is so charismatic and so she's exciting and for that reason threatening to the kinds of people on the right you were just talking about in a way that Barack Obama was too. And she has the potential to be this real crossover figure and to make less threatened white people feel like a person of color can, you know, rise to the very top. I mean, look, this is all sort of premature. This person isn't even 30 yet. Who knows what will happen to her? But she looks like the kind of potentially transformative figure in American politics who could transcend these racial divides. And so then there's an even greater incentive to try to make her seem kind of other in this way that I think some white conservatives tend to do with people of color all the time. And I mean, the explanation for it, unfortunately, I think lies in the way in which the Republican Party and to some degree, American conservatism is white. Like, we are heading into this world. I think already 90% of Republicans are white. And so this, I mean, I think it's like one of the most troubling things happening in America today. And it explains so much polarization that if you have a political party that isn't even trying to reach out to people of color and the kind of, you know, recognizing the diversifying of America and celebrating that, then you have this potential for exactly the kind of taking down and demonizing that you're talking about, where it becomes racial instead of just being about things like policy differences, right? I mean, you can, if you're on the right, you can attack Ocasio-Cortez for the Green New Deal, or you can start talking about like her nickname in high school. Now, which of these things really matters? Where should people really be having issues with her?
Well, and it's much more effective to do the second if you believe the theory of politics that people vote their sort of their guts more than their brain, because the kind of attacks that you've just described, Emily, they one, undermine the person themselves by making them seem like a phony. But then it is also an echo of or in concert with an existing view of the world, which argues that people of color get undeserved advantages at the expense of the white working class, the sort of so-called free phones or not so-called. But I mean, it's like the free phones version of a human, which is like, and that resonates in a way that's played on in lots of other different ways.
Right. And then the problem, of course, is that you're preventing class solidarity, right? Like the Green New Deal, if it occurred, would bring jobs to lots of dispossessed white people across the country. It could fix these problems we've had with factories closing down and deindustrialization, put people back to work in the very kind of, you know, infrastructure jobs that we need in those places that could go to a lot of white men in particular who, you know, seem to be flailing and feeling like they're on the decline. So if you can instead just like de-authenticate the people of color who are championing these ideas, then, you know, you prevent that kind of unifying, which like most Americans do actually agree on and most Americans would stand to benefit from.
How do we talk about the fact that she's extraordinarily attractive? And this is, I think it's a Beto thing, too, that one of the reasons why he did so well is that he's just a really, really appealing, physically appealing. She's extraordinarily good looking.
Don't leave Barack Obama out of this conversation.
And Barack Obama, yeah, and Barack Obama for sure. And the Sarah Palin piece of it. Like, is that just we need to avoid it, stay out of it, it's off limits?
So why is it off limits?
Well, I don't know if there's a good, productive way to talk
about it. What is the best argument for why it's off limits? I mean, I know what the best argument is, but I'm...
Well, say it. I don't know. Don't pose a rhetorical question that I can't answer.
Because it objectifies her, right? This should be about ideas and not about the person. The problem is presidential campaigns and politics.
David will have to talk about whether he wants to be with her or not, and he'd prefer not to have to go down that road.
Jesus, so, Emily.
That's not what he was saying.
That's so
never,
gross.
He would never have that idea. No men in America are thinking about that right now.
And so the problem is that once you even open the door for a dispassionate, open the door for even a dispassionate conversation about this, you end up falling well down in, as we are currently doing. But the reason it's an interesting question, of course, David, is because we know that the way people make their decisions about things, particularly in a campaign context and particularly in a presidential campaign context, is not based on the dispassionate, cool application of reason to the great problems of the day.
All right. Last question about AOC.
Can I just add one other thing, though, about her?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Well, no, I mean, that's the tension in his question. Isn't it? I mean, or do you think that people really do vote based simply on the quality of the ideas and it has nothing to do with the person who communicates them?
Well, of course I don't think that, because that would be...
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Really,
that's the tension in the question.
Yes,
tension in the question.
I was just laughing because I think it's impossible to ignore this. And because a lot of the attacks on her, the belittling of her is related to her sexuality, it's on the table for that reason, and is... Of course we can talk about it. What I appreciate about her tremendously is how comfortable she seems in her own body. I think it is unusual to see someone on the public political stage who just seems to fully own her physical presence. And I really welcome the message that sends to girls and young women. And of course, it could be tied to her, the fact that she's hugely attractive, but it also just like has to do with, I don't know, it seems like a core part of her persona that we can celebrate, like, separately from the fact that she is extraordinarily beautiful.
Right, which you might just label, I mean, I think that you make an excellent point, and particularly on the modeling question, but which you might label in another context just sheer authenticity, which is to say, or whatever we call authenticity in the context of politics, which is the seeming appearance of a person being completely comfortable with who they are, what they're saying, and what they believe, and not being someone who is totally prepackaged.
Yes,
I should
exactly.
add one final note to this conversation, I think, which is a part of it, and I don't know where it fits, but I mean, it is not crazy for people to react negatively to a newcomer in political life when they are young and saying brash things. When Tom Dewey decided to run when he was quite a youngster, they joked that instead of throwing his hat into the presidential ring, he threw his diaper into the ring. It was an effort to belittle him and make his youth a liability and not a benefit, and he didn't go anywhere in 1956 anyway. But Whoopi Goldberg was critical of Ocasio-Cortez because she argued that her criticisms of the Democratic Party didn't give the existing Democrats who've been fighting for the same values any credit for all the work they're done. And she finished her remarks by saying, "You just got there and I know you've got lots of good ideas, but I would encourage you to sit still for a minute and learn the job." So Whoopi Goldberg is not exactly a raging conservative. And so I think that reaction is coming towards her as well.
I think that's such a misguided reaction. The job these days is actually the job of a House member these days is not to legislate. There is no legislation that passes the House. It's not a serious legislative chamber. The job is to be a kind of public figure around ideas and to create a sort of drama and buzz and a national identity. That's what we've the evidence of the last 25 years is that. And she has she shouldn't sit still and wait. She should teach other people in the Democratic caucus. Here's how you use Instagram. Here are ways to put ideas out in the public. She has a gift and a skill and an ability to reach an audience that 99 out of, 100 new members or any members of Congress do not have. And that's her job. Is her job is not to wait. It's to push.
Right. I mean, another thing about her that I find compelling is that she doesn't seem to limit herself to talking points when she's giving interviews. She seems to just talk. And like when she's on Instagram cooking some, recipe involving beans from her grandmother, it's an extension of that. And to the degree that that's spilling over more broadly into politics, to me, that just is so welcome. I'm so tired of the retreat into talking points. It's so boring. I was watching this like 1 minute video the other night of a newly elected state representative in Connecticut whose name is Ann Hughes. And she just had this camera on her as she was entering the Connecticut state capitol. I don't know if she was going there for the first time or what, but it was like kind of, clumsily shot. She had some bag of stuff from her local constituent. She was just like excited to be there. And it was just sort of charming in a kind of wacky way. And I feel like the more we have that in American politics, like, good. I'm all for that.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you're making your Cortez cocktails, Emily. What are you going to be chattering
about
this
week? Well, I'm sorry because this is sort of a sober topic, but I read an amazing piece this week by...
Ironically, for cocktails.
I read an amazing piece this week by Tressie McMillan Cottom, who is an American writer. She's also a sociologist at Virginia Commonwealth University. And she wrote a piece in Time about her own pregnancy. And it was a lost pregnancy. She had a stillbirth. And what she was really writing about was the way she was viewed as a Black woman and the problem of competence in healthcare, where she was reporting symptoms that should have been taken in by her doctor as truly alarming and instead were kind of brushed off or ignored. And this is a larger problem we're having right now where maternal mortality rates are higher for Black women in America in a way that is about race as well as class and is deeply troubling. And it was just such a powerful use of one's own story to make a point with other evidence behind it and to, really like interrogate this problem of how we see different people when they present as patients. So I really recommend it, and in particular her thinking about how, despite the fact that she's well educated, that, she speaks in a way you would expect of an educated person, she still felt like she was viewed as an incompetent purveyor of her own symptoms in a way that led to this tragic outcome. It really made me think.
Yeah, it was such a hard piece to read.
Yeah. Mm.
JD, what is your Cortez cocktail?
Well, mine is one of, I feel like I could do every cocktail chatter about something I find on Brain Pickings. But this one in particular I liked. I can't remember what wandered me there into this thicket. But anyway, it's when Walt Whitman first self-published Leaves of Grass. That was another book. It was basically panned. It didn't sell well, and it was not warmly received. And Leaves of Grass had been inspired by an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson, an essay called The Poet. And so Whitman, while he's down in the dumps, gets a letter from Emerson, who says that Leaves of Grass is amazing. He starts his letter by saying, "I am not blind to the worth of the wonderful gift of Leaves of Grass." So I would encourage everybody to read this letter from Emerson, which is great because it contains just great sentences like the idea that there is too much lymph in the temperament that is making our Western wits fat and mean. So go read it, and it's wonderful. But more important is the sentiment behind it, which is the idea that people who create and people who are sometimes in need of bucking up, and that a letter like this can be a ray of sunshine in an otherwise very dark moment, which is exactly what it was for Whitman.
When I toured the National Archives, I think I'm correct in saying this. I had a behind-the-scenes tour of the National Archives a few years ago, which was magnificent. And one of the things I saw there was a letter of recommendation that Emerson wrote for Whitman to get a job at whatever government agency he was going to work at.
A nurse? Because he was a nurse during the Civil War.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. I love the idea of that. Emerson is writing letters of recommendation for Whitman. My chatter, just a couple. One, first a log-rolling one, which is that my dear company, Atlas Obscura, and actually Emily's dear company, The New York Times, have just teamed up on a great partnership, and I invite you to check it out, which is that we are together going to do one weekend in London and one weekend in Los Angeles, and each weekend is going to be you're going to spend the whole weekend learning about the history of that city and the future of that city around science. We call them Science Weekend. So in London, there'll be a kind of surgery exhibition at the old operating theater, and then a dinner with the Worshipful Society of Apothecaries. And in Los Angeles, there'll be sky photography and a behind-the-scenes access to the Dino Lab at the Natural History Museum. And there'll be Times journalists as educators. And it's going to be a fantastic combination of Atlas Obscura's hidden wonders and the Times' expertise. And I really would love for you to come join us on one of these trips, one in L.A. in May.
That sounds so great.
Yeah, they're going to be great. They're really going to be great. L.A. is in May, and the London one is in September. So check them out on atlasobscura.com/trips, or just email me at david@atlasobscura.com, and I can point them to you. The other chatter I just want to point out is an excellent, interesting column also in the Times, which we almost did as a topic, about income sharing agreements, which is this new idea in education. There's several schools that are being set up. In this case, it's a school called Lambda School, where you do not pay tuition, and you go to it's higher education, and you go to this program, and when you come out, you pay a percentage of your income. If your income is over a certain amount, you pay a percentage of your income to the school, and that's your effective tuition payment. So if you go out, you get a job that pays you $70,000 a year, you pay 17% of your salary back to the school, and that funds it. And for certain people, if you get a great job, you'll end up paying a lot more probably than you would have paid in tuition. And if you get a mediocre job, you won't end up paying any tuition. But it incentivizes the school to train you in skills that are going to make you a valuable employee in certain areas. So they're focusing on things like data science and coding. And it's both an interesting – it's a kind of apprenticeship, more apprenticeshipy model. It's a challenge to the basic idea of the liberal arts education, which has been so dominant in higher education. And it's an attack on public and private universities in some ways, because these are different entities that are going to be offering these more practical programs. But I think it's really worth looking at, and I bet it gets a lot of traction. I know that when I look at – people I'm employing for coding jobs, there are a lot of people who've come out of code academies, which often function the same way. So check out this piece in the Times about income sharing agreements. And of course, we have a listener chatter. You should tweet your listener chatter to us at @SlateGabFest or share it on Facebook at facebook.com/GabFest. This week, Mike Stannis and Nicole Garten both sent us the same piece. Mike's comment on Twitter was, "Hey, at Slate Gabfest, my cocktail chat this week is a long piece about millennial burnout. It's incredibly refreshing to read something about my own generation, which actually gets close to how it feels to be part of it." And it's a piece in BuzzFeed called "How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation." It was all over my Twitter this week. And a lot of us Gen Xers were like, "Yeah, cry me a river, millennials. tired of hearing you guys complain. But it gets at a point about what is so exhausting about young professional life and how much running it feels just to stay in the same place, not to get anywhere. So it's I recommend that piece that Mike Stanis and Nicole Garten point us to. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Gabe Roth is the editorial director of Slate Audio. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet chatter at us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening, and come to our live show in D.C. where we will be huzzahing and praising and talking about Emily's book on March 27th at the Lincoln Theater, slate.com/live for tickets to that. We will talk to you next week.
Ever listen to podcasts with your kids? It's a great way to keep them entertained and engage their minds without relying on screens. I want to tell you about a new kids' history podcast hosted by me, Joy Dolo. It's called Forever Ago, and I teamed up with the producers of the award-winning kids podcast, Brains On, to make it. Forever Ago dives into the amazing backstories of everyday stuff, like emojis, video games, and skateboards. We use games, skits, and kid co-hosts to keep the whole family engaged, while teaching listeners to think critically about history. Along the way, we'll hear some incredible stories, like how a curious teenager revolutionized skateboarding.
Gnarly.
How alarm clocks used to just be people. Rise and shine. And how the poop emoji almost didn't happen. You can find Forever Ago on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.